Welcome to Night Sky Tourist, a place to learn the night sky, have fun with its ancient stories, meet astronomers and dark sky advocates, and fall in love with the dark. I'm Vicki Dirksen, your host and author of the website and blog, nightskytourist.com. If you've never visited the website, I invite you to stop by after the podcast. Check out some of the great blog articles, browse through the resource page, and sign up for the newsletters. The newsletters have great content that is exclusive for subscribers. Are you ready for an adventure under the night sky? Let's jump right in. Hey friends, I am so excited to share with you that Night Sky Tourist is celebrating its second anniversary. What an amazing adventure we've been on over these last 2 years. I have to say that my heart is full because of all the wonderful people who've joined me episode after episode to chat about such fascinating topics. You know, fewer than 20% of all new podcasts survive to the end of their first year. So I feel really lucky this year. Thank you to every one of you for your support and encouragement as we jump into another year.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, Night Sky Tourist Podcast. Happy birthday to you.
I was 14 years old the first time I ever saw fireflies. I grew up along the Snake River in northern Idaho, and I never saw a firefly. But in junior high, we went to Iowa to visit my dad's extended family, and I got to experience the magic of fireflies. And honestly, I don't know if there is a better word to describe fireflies other than magical, unless maybe it's the word mesmerizing. I remember running alongside the neighborhood train tracks where my relatives lived in Iowa, trying to catch some fireflies in a jar. And when a train whooshed by, I would hold up my jar of fireflies to show to the conductor. I was pretty proud of my catch. The magic is doubled when the fireflies flicker above the ground and the stars are twinkling brightly overhead. But I keep coming across these articles that talk about the decline of firefly populations, and it really breaks my heart. You might as well tell me that part of Disneyland is on fire. Then I learned that one of the big contributors to this problem is light pollution, and I got a little bit excited because dark sky preservation is in my wheelhouse. I can help save the fireflies at the same time I'm saving the night sky. But I also learned why light pollution is harming the fireflies, and I was so fascinated by what I was learning. So I reached out to Ben Pfeiffer. He's the founder of the website firefly.org, and we had a really interesting conversation about the topic. I learned so much, and I hope to inspire people who live around fireflies to do their part to save them. Ben is the founder of Firefly Conservation and Research at firefly.org, which is a nonprofit dedicated to firefly conservation and education. His website is currently the most visited website about fireflies. Ben is a well-known public speaker and science educator, and he's working to document the diversity of fireflies in every state. And he's also documenting their natural history, which includes their life cycle, their preferred habitats, and their unique flash patterns. He's a member of the International Union for the Conservation of Nature Firefly Working Group. He recently completed the Red List Extinction Risk Assessments for Texas Firefly Species that was published back in May 2021. Please join me in welcoming to the podcast, Ben Pfeiffer. Ben, thank you so much for joining me on the Night Sky Tourist podcast. We get to talk about a really fun topic today, and that's fireflies.
Yeah.
So you are the founder of firefly.org, is that correct?
I am. I'm the founder of Firefly Conservation and Research. It was founded in 2009, and it was really to bring awareness to the decline of fireflies across the United States and worldwide, and just educate people on ways that they could help them. I also study fireflies here in Texas academically, so I study the different species that occur here, and do a lot of field research that then aids in scientific papers and other organizations that look to protect those species. And so I just really had a burning question of like what was actually here. And to my amazement, there hadn't been a lot of research to really figure out exactly what was exactly here in Texas. And so it's been a really fun adventure and kind of an odyssey across the state and different parts of connecting with, landowners and people that are passionate about conservation work and want to protect fireflies. And so it's a the mission is to protect fireflies and then also raise issue raise awareness to issues that are affecting them, like dark skies stuff.
And, I live in Arizona and we don't have fireflies here, at least not in the desert. We don't have them in the desert. And I grew up in northern Idaho. I don't remember ever seeing fireflies there either. And so when you and I first connected and you were talking about Texas, I honestly had no idea that Texas had fireflies. So
Yeah.
for people like me who had ignorant ideas, where do fireflies live in our country?
Yeah, so that's a good question. And Arizona actually does have fireflies, in New Mexico as well. And they actually had a really pretty good year. There's a species that occurs there, that's a synchronous firefly species. And so, for example, there's a lot of people that email me from Santa Fe this year talking about how they had fireflies, a lot of fireflies that they'd never seen before. To your question, fireflies actually occur in a lot of states that a lot of people don't realize. So you can find them in the West, in places like Arizona, Colorado, Utah, Idaho. Some of these areas just haven't gotten a lot of attention or study, particularly. There's some interesting research going on in Utah, for example, about a species that is occurring there, and they're trying to identify if it's a new thing or not. But for the most part, they occur in most of the lower 48. There are a few states that don't have necessarily fireflies that flash, but pretty much most of the states have the family Lampyridae, which is where most of fireflies fit in. Now, some of those species are going to be those that don't flash, that use pheromones, for example. You'll tend to find those more along the West Coast. The predominant, I guess, density of flashing fireflies kind of tends to occur from New Mexico, Texas, all the way up to the Mid-Atlantic, up into that region. And then in the Midwest has quite a large number of fireflies as well. There's a lot of people that talk about, just the tons of fireflies they see every year. And so they're all over. Texas and Georgia and Florida have kind of some of the highest concentrations of species.
And so my question has always been, because I've actually never been able to talk to someone who's an expert about it, how the heck do they light up? What makes
Yeah.
them magic?
Yeah, I know. It's like in the animal kingdom, it's a really special thing for an organism to like emit light. There's not that many that actually do that. And so it is a curious fascination about the wonder that fireflies create with that light. And how they do that is a combination of basically an enzyme and an enzymatic catalyst. There's a the luciferin molecule, basically, and then there's luciferase, which is the kind of amino acid. And so what happens is that fireflies breathe in oxygen, and what it does is that charges that molecule in that amino acid, and basically it charges up through a chemical formula, and the formula is out there for bioluminescence, and it charges it up until it gets to excited state, and then when it's full, it basically releases those photons and those oxygen ions basically out, and that's what creates the light. And so fireflies regulate their flashing based on the amount of oxygen that they're bringing in. Used to, years ago, maybe 50 years ago or so, chemical companies used to pay people to collect fireflies so they could collect those compounds. And they'd pay them 5 cents a firefly. And they used to advertise in guides and stuff. And occasionally I've seen some old photos of those advertisements. But now those chemical companies can manufacture those compounds synthetically. And they use those compounds for medical research and food safety research. So they're useful in the lab for a lot of things that people use. So it's amazing that they've been able to synthesize those compounds and then use them.
I've seen articles over the last few years, and not just one, it's been a number of them, that have talked about how we've been losing our firefly populations, a significant number of them. How many would you say that we've lost, and what are the main causes of losing them?
Yeah, so I can really mainly quote some Xerces and U International Conservation for Union Research has been doing some studies into the disappearance of fireflies and classifying them based on available data, whether they're threatened or endangered. And so right now in the United States, there's around about 18% of populations that are threatened or, somewhere along that chain, whether they might be close to extinction. There's some firefly populations that are their habitat is so small that like if it was wiped out, they'd get wiped out. These are things like the in Delaware, the Bethany Beach firefly, for example, that occurs just in sand dunes. There are, threats to them considerably, and there's a collection of data that try to determine this right now. I used to say there was just kind of anecdotal evidence basically about firefly disappearance, but as more empirical evidence has kind of started to pile up, we can kind of now say a little more definitively, these are definitely like threatened and deserve some kind of protection from, threats outside.
What are you seeing that's coming in and disrupting their ability to survive?
Another great question, because it's like we want to kind of hone in on what are the causes of the disappearance. One of the main things is habitat loss. And that's the one that if you ask any firefly researcher, they'll pretty much tell you that's one of the main con like number one reasons. Habitat loss and degradation of habitats. So this is where you've got habitats that used to occur at their max potential biologically and ecologically that have either been degraded from disruptions, land use conversion, and then also just complete disappearance. Like they just get bulldozed over and then cemented or concrete, over. So habitat loss is one of them that's big. Light pollution is also a really concern too, and there's scientific studies that back this up. And the real main reason for a light pollution problem is that a female firefly needs to be able to see a male firefly and vice versa. And they need really dark habitats a lot of times for their light to, thin out as far as possible to potential mates. And when you have light pollution or artificial light at night, it can make it difficult for those males and females to find each other at night because there's light that's basically penetrating the habitat that's, influencing them to be able to see each other. If you have that problem, then they can't mate, they can't, raise offspring, lay eggs, all that stuff to the next generation, and then you get a decline essentially. There's different things that people can do to help them with that, and so we can discuss those in a little bit. But the third reason would be maybe pesticide usage, for example, and basically broad spectrum pesticides, people spraying their lawns and stuff like that in habitats with pesticides. If anything that's designed to kill beetles is also going to kill a firefly because a firefly is a beetle. You just need to be a little conscious of spraying and like how you're applying pesticides in the environment, where you're at.
So obviously, I'm not going to take any of these measures because I don't have fireflies here in the Phoenix area. But people around the country who do have firefly populations, what can they do as individuals to help protect them?
The first thing I'd recommend for people to do is actually go out into their habitat and see what they have. What kind of fireflies are flashing out there? And where are they like flashing? Where are they occurring? Like if you see something flashing in a leaf litter in the grass, like just mark that off as like this is a place that fireflies are flashing. So identify where they're actually at. Because that's going to help that will make your efforts most valuable in terms to help them. There's a lot of things people can do to help fireflies in their particular habitat. If you've got a wild area or a pollinator garden or habitat, for example, where you've identified fireflies, be sure to limit mowing and destruction of that particular habitat. You can aid in actually building that habitat up by adding native plants, for example. Native plants tend to have long root systems that retain soil moisture or moisture in the soil. And so that soil moisture provides habitat for fireflies as they, hide between blades of grass and stuff like that overnight, I mean, during the day. And then they retain moisture in the soil, which also attracts the food that fireflies need to eat. So fireflies eat snails and slugs and worms and stuff like that. And so if you've got food for fireflies, then you'll attract them essentially. And so it's kind of a, a two, you're building habitat for fireflies, but also for the food they eat essentially. And so that kind of goes back to the pesticide usage issues. If you're treating for pests somewhat, you might be killing the food that they might be eating. So another thing is turn off outside lights, specifically those that are that kind of broadcast light in all directions, and as opposed to being downward facing lights. You don't want some like accidental light to shine into a habitat that's going to disrupt their mating habitat, for example. We're all familiar with those really bright street lights, that have that cone around them, and they're mercury vapor lights. Those are horrible for fireflies. A lot of times people put them on the outside of the garage, or in a particular area to light up, take it down, or put a shield around it. So, and then if you're looking to adapt your lights, consider changing the bulb as well to more of an amber colored light that's a little bit softer on your eyes for humans, but also for fireflies too. That amber light doesn't influence as much as some of the bright bluish kind of white LEDs that can do that. You can look at your land, try to prevent mowing on riparian corridors. So these are, if you've got land that's on a river or a stream, a lot of times people mow right up to the water. Okay. Well, most fireflies occur in a riparian corridor, which is that strip of vegetation that occurs on a stream or a river. And so if you're cutting that or you're mowing that down, you're basically mowing firefly habitat down. And so a lot of people want to create like a park-like setting, but it's not always the best for your habitat. So oftentimes I get complaints from people's like, I don't have fireflies anymore. I don't happen. We've got this creek in our backyard and it's so wonderful. And I'm like, well, tell me a little bit how you're managing it. You can buy land to protect species. This is a great one. Educate your neighbors. You can also take some steps to certify your habitat. And so Firefly Conservation and Research has launched a new habitat certification program. And so people can go on the firefly.org website and purchase a certified firefly habitat sign. And this is a great way because it comes with a guide, basically. It's a great way to basically take a habitat and kind of rehab it, essentially. Follow what's in the guide, check off those boxes, basically, and kind of do a self-directed certification. And then let people know what's there, that there's a firefly habitat there. You can support dark sky initiatives. That's also great as well. Those all benefit fireflies, substantially. So those are some wonderful ways that you can do that.
I think it's so interesting, some of these things that you've mentioned. I'm thinking of the overlap that these suggestions have with so many other things. It's easy for us, I think, to take an issue like fireflies, for example, and just look at it as, well, we're helping fireflies. But you have said things that I think people can do to protect monarch butterflies. Those, I think, recently just went on the endangered list, didn't they? I think it was the monarchs. They've been in trouble for a while. And a lot of the things that you've suggested are the same kinds of things that are suggested for protecting them. A lot of the tips that you've given about the lights are the same tips that we give people for protecting the dark skies. And so, nature just all works in tandem. And I just thought of all of those different things as you were saying that. So, it's not like we have to always go out and do all of these things to protect this one thing and then 100 other things over here. No, a lot of these things overlap so much.
They overlap so much because a lot of the other species also depend on those same factors in order for their survival. With the monarchs, they're migratory, and they need habitat that's going to support milkweed.
There's a book that I really want to recommend to people as we're talking about this, and it's called Nature's New Hope. I believe that's what it's called. And I'm going to put the link to that book in the show notes for people to look up. But it's talking a lot about this, how people can take their yards and think about them almost as like a miniature national park, on your own property, and the things that you can do to provide a better place for all kinds, birds, or even, like you're talking about little beetles and how important they are, and moths and all these things. And there's so many cool things we can do to turn our yards into a friendly place to all of these species.
Yeah, I would recommend that book. And if people are interested in a firefly book, there's a great field guide out there called Fireflies, Lightning Bugs, and Glowworms by Lynn Faust. She did fireflies kind of in the Northeast. And that's a really good field guide out for that particular area. But yeah, kind of arm yourself with information.
Yeah, and I really want everybody to go visit your website at firefly.org. I know that your website is just filled with great information and a lot of good resources, and that's where they can find out about the Certified Firefly Habitat Program. Well, Ben, thank you so much for sharing with us here on Night Sky Tourist. This is really good information, and we're going to load up the show notes with some good links.
Awesome. Yeah, thanks, Vicky, for having me. I really appreciate being on today.
The Star Tour is coming up in just a minute, but before we jump into it, I want to remind you how important your reviews are to me. Instead of asking for your dollars to support this podcast, I'm asking for your 5-star reviews. How many times have you searched for a new podcast and you looked at the rating and read the reviews before ever listening to an episode? I do that all the time. It's how I decide if a new podcast is worth my time. Please take a moment right now or at the end of the show to let the world know that Night Sky Tourist is stellar. Leave 5 stars and a written review. I've met some of you in person, and you're so kind to tell me how much you love Night Sky Tourist. If that's you and you haven't left a written review, now's your chance to let the rest of the world know how you feel. Thank you for your words of support because it makes my day to hear them. It's time for our tour across the night sky for November 8th through 21st, 2022. Pause the podcast, gather everyone in your house, and I'll meet you outside under the stars. If you start stargazing no earlier than 8:30 p.m., you're going to be able to see Mars rising above the eastern horizon. It has a distinctly reddish-orange color, and it does not twinkle. In fact, planets never twinkle, only stars do. The ancient Sumerians called Mars Nergal, the god of war and plague. Nergal eventually grew in popularity as a god, with his main cult centered in the city of Nineveh. In Mesopotamian texts, Mars is called the star of judgment of the fate of the dead. Egyptian astronomers recognized Mars as a wandering object, which was distinct from the stars as early as 1534 BCE. Later, Babylonian astronomers invented arithmetic methods for predicting the position of the planets. Mars got its modern name from the Romans, who named it after their god of war, which was Mars. And Aristotle was the first to note that Mars disappeared behind the moon in the 4th century BCE. This is how they knew that Mars was farther away than the moon. Chinese astronomers knew Mars was a planet around the 4th century BCE as well. And the first person to ever look at Mars through a telescope was Galileo in the year 1610. And it was the Dutch astronomer Christian Huygens who first drew the terrain features of Mars. Now, Percival Lowell, he was the founder of Lowell Observatory in Flagstaff, Arizona, where Pluto was discovered in 1930. But before that, Lowell was smitten by this suggestion that there were grooves on the surface of Mars, and that word grooves was mistranslated in English as canals. And Percival Lowell thought that those canals were actually constructed by extraterrestrial beings. He swore he could see water running through these canals. Later studies, though, concluded that Lowell was actually seeing the blood running through the veins in his own eyes as he strained to look through the telescope. Another cool object in that general region is also just above the eastern horizon, but it's a bit farther north than Mars. You'll see a bright star that looks like it's blinking or flickering. I was recently at a stargazing event, and some of the participants were making bets that it was an airplane, not a star, because of the way that it blinked. I assured them it was the bright star Capella in the constellation Auriga, but we had to look through the telescope to settle the disagreement. And I love how this star flickers red and green and white. A little farther southwest of Mars is another red celestial object. It's smaller than Mars, and it twinkles. It's the star Aldebaran in the constellation Taurus. If you look at Taurus with a stargazing app on your phone, you'll notice the star looks like the bull's angry red eye. Just a bit to the west of red Aldebaran is a cluster of small but bright stars called the Pleiades. People often mistake this for the Little Dipper because of its shape. If you look at it with the naked eye, you can count 6 stars. Yet we have dozens of star stories from around the world that call it the Seven Sisters. I'll be sharing some of those stories with you in a future episode. But if you look at Pleiades with a telescope, you will see a stunning field of many stars. Look directly overhead and you're gonna see what's known as the Great Square of Pegasus. Pegasus is much larger than just the giant square. It's the winged horse of ancient mythology. And again, you might need the stargazing app on your phone to be able to see all of it. Be sure to check out the show notes for links to all the things mentioned in this episode or visit nightskytourist.com/52. Thank you for joining me for another episode of the Night Sky Tourist Podcast. If you enjoy the Night Sky Tourist Podcast, please show your support by subscribing to it in your podcatcher and leave a written review. Your reviews are really important to me, and they help others discover the podcast. Be sure to visit nightskytourist.com for great articles and resources. And while you're there, sign up for the newsletter for exclusive content. We'll see you here again in 2 weeks. Until then, keep looking up.